Do you have some serious FOMO about missing Creative South this year? Well, you're in luck. We just opened up streaming passes. That's right, we're going to be streaming the talks Friday and Saturday live from Creative South. This is your chance to see all of the speakers and presenters without having to leave the comfort of your own sofa. But that's not all. You can also participate in the live Q&A by tweeting to your favorite presenter and using the hashtag CS18. And we'll be doing a real-time live feed of the Q&A. Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today, I'm chatting with the founder of Logo Lounge, Bill Gardner. We talk about putting himself through college by performing magic, how Logo Lounge started, and the impact it's had on our industry. Defending intellectual property in India after one of his logos was stolen, identifying and forecasting logo trends, and more, all right after this. It's no secret that I love Jack Prince. They're a longtime sponsor of the podcast and Creative South. Plus, they do great work. Whether they're making our pop-up displays and tablecloths or printing notebooks, Jack Prince is always there when we need them. This year, they are printing new Creative South t-shirts for me and the podcast stickers. They have a coupon code on the back that gives you a great discount on all of their products, just in time for Creative South. Speaking of stickers, Jack Prince will print any kind, shape, size, or stock, including full-color stickers with full-color liner prints, for you to use as product labels, promotions, bumper stickers, hang tags, business cards, and more. Right now, you can get 500 3x3-inch die-cut stickers, starting at $149. Plus, Jack Prince is giving Creative South podcast listeners 15% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code SOUTH15OFF at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today. At Creative South, we love Astute Graphics plugins. Astute Graphics makes innovative plugins for Adobe Illustrator. These popular plugins lead the way in imaginative tools for vector designers that significantly save time, boost creativity, and achieve amazing results. Astute Graphics have developed 16 popular plugins over the past 11 years, including the new Phantasm 4. Phantasm 4 enables true live effect, 100% scalable vector halftone control, plus duotone and comprehensive color adjustment. The new halftone feature now includes the easy clip to shape function. Easily adjust vector artwork, text, effects, and embed images with curves and other essential controls, just like Photoshop, directly in Illustrator. Phantasm 4 includes user-defined adjustment to ensure a fast workflow and maximum creativity, perfect for both designers and for prepress. Phantasm 4 and all Astute Graphics plugins come with a full, unrestricted, free 14-day trial. If you buy Phantasm 3 as part of their 30% off sale, you'll get a free upgrade to Phantasm 4. Details available at www.astutegraphics.com. Go ahead and give them a try. If you like the Creative South podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Every dollar helps us cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. With options starting at just $1 per month, you can help support the podcast and even wind up with some cool Creative South podcast swag. When you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, a shout out on the podcast thanking you for your support, Creative South podcast stickers and t-shirts. So, please help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. Bill, thanks for joining me this morning.
This is fun, Jason. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I really appreciate you taking the time. It's especially coming into the office on a Sunday.
So what you don't know is that Saturday and Sunday are my days to get everything done. So I find opportunities to escape the office to go spend some time with my daughter or my wife or something like that for an hour or two, and then I'm back to the office. They kind of know that.
Is that just because it's kind of quiet around there and nobody else is there?
You know, It is. That's helpful. So right now, and especially moving into the spring, and of course, we're going to be doing this down at Creative South, but I'm in the throes of pulling together the trend report right now for the for Logo Lounge, and for we'll be presenting it there and at the How Design Conference and How Design Live. And we do a Lynda video or a now it's LinkedIn Learning video on it and release it in a lot of publications. So this is where I really need you to call me and give me that break, because otherwise I'm so immersed in logos and looking at everything that I kind of go snowblind.
I can imagine, because I know you've got a talk with Von Glitschke coming up too.
We do, yeah. And that's going to be fun. Vaughn and I go way back. We actually kind of, I don't want to say we introduced Vaughn, but one of the very first members of Logo Lounge ever was Felix Sockwell, like on the very first day. And I got to talking to Felix and said, anybody out there I really need to contact and get involved in this? And he goes, There's this kid that's drawing sports cards, working for, you know, some, you know, kind of like football card and baseball card company named Von Glitschke. I was going, no, a name like that, it's never going to work. But contacted Von, and Von got involved. I don't think I've ever really talked about this, but no, Von and I go back to about 2001 when we started up the Logo Lounge project. So that's pretty cool.
Wow. Yeah. That's back when he was doing Upper Deck and all that stuff too.
Yes, exactly. And he and I were, so this little Tulsa thing that we're doing, for the Tulsa Art Directors Club that's coming up is, Vaughn and I were sitting down, this is a couple of years ago. It was down in Atlanta, down in your hometown area, kind of area.
Yeah.
And we were at the How Design Live, and it was about 1 a.m. And we were just the two of us sitting there, and one of the attendees from Tulsa came over and started talking to us about would either one of us like to come to Tulsa and speak. And we kind of looked at each other and I said, hey, Vaughn, why don't we just do it together? And so 2 years later, here we are.
Wow. So let's kind of dive in from your early beginnings. Where did you grow up?
Well, okay, this is where I make myself look very small town. So we're speaking today from our office in Wichita, Kansas, which is a population of on the outside, if you include the outside communities, about 500,000. But it's the largest community in Kansas, and my office is about 4 blocks away from my home, which is in a really, really old kind of stately part of Wichita called College Hill, which is about 4 blocks away from the hospital I was born in, called Wesley Hospital. So here within, you know, a mile of each other is pretty much my life. So, you know, when we get out and we start doing conferences, or I go out speaking and people ask me, you know, where I'm from, I say, I'm very definitely from Wichita.
Yeah, all your life. Wow. That's impressive.
No, it works. It works.
Yeah. So when you're growing up, what type of kid were you? Were you sporty? Were you arty kid? Nerdy kid?
Yeah, definitely not the sporty kid. I don't have a athletic bone in my body. Wow, you don't really want this to see. I never really talk about this. I was a failure. I was a dramatic failure. I was one of 5 kids. I was the youngest.
Sure.
And so had a dad who was in World War II in the European theater. And, you know, I mean, it you know, really goes back. So I'm the youngest of the boomer generation. Mm-hmm. And I was now they call it attention deficit disorder, ADD. They didn't have a name for it then. There you go. And I was the class clown, and literally had multiple talks with my parents about holding me back for another year. And my dad, who I, you know, was a genius and I loved, looking at me and saying, Bill, at this rate, you're not going to go to college. And, you know, I I literally was just kind of a I was the kid that, you know, everybody looked at and go, wow, he's bound to be a failure. And
sounds like
I
me.
Was, you see, hey, it's working out okay. So in seventh grade, my dad dropped a camper on my head. Yeah, I know. He was just really mad at me. No, it was, we used to go pheasant hunting back here in Kansas. Okay. And it was a male bonding kind of thing. And it was a Friday off of school that, you know, you could take, and all the men in our family would pack up and we'd go off pheasant hunting.
Sure.
And we were loading up a camper on the side of our house. So there's this big winch and you kind of crank it up and you back the truck underneath it. And I'm out there in seventh grade, I don't know, pajamas or something like that. And the winch broke. And the camper came tumbling down and hit me on the head, and I didn't have time to bend my knees, so it broke my back. And,
oh, my God.
That's okay. They threw me into the hospital, and at that point they started doing all kinds of electroencephalograms and the likes to make sure it hadn't caused any brain damage, which it may well have. I don't know. but what they came back with was they discovered that there was a little graze on my brain that had been there since childhood that was part of the challenge with my lack of attention. So they put me on a medication that I stayed on pretty much through the end of high school that kind of calmed me down a little bit. And I always call them my smart pills, because from that point forward, my grades started to rise and I started getting involved in activities. And by the time I was out of college, I'd been the freshman class president and the sophomore class president, and winning acting awards and getting involved in debate and forensics and taking awards there. And so those were kind of my smart pills. I just got highly involved in things. And so it kind of turned around. Same story that you had, right?
I did call mine my smart pills. They definitely did not help me that much. I did. you got a lot more focus out of yours than I did out of mine.
You know, I think that there is value when we have somebody point out to us that, you know, on the path that you're on right now, it's kind of a challenge when you're told that you're probably not going to accomplish much.
Sure. Yeah. I've had that conversation many a times. It really didn't sink in for a lot of the times though.
And, you know, I came out of a family of, now they call it entrepreneurs. Back then they just called it, you know, business folk that started their own business. I picked up a degree in business from Wichita State and went up to Kansas State long enough to, I put myself through school doing magic. And
okay,
you
got to go dive into that too. How did you get into the magic?
So I'll go back to that, but I'll cap this off by saying, okay, I ended up coming back to Wichita State after Kansas State. I was pursuing a degree in design up there. Found out they didn't have much of a program at the time. Came back here, finished that up. So I've got a degree in business and a degree in design. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of merging the two together into a design business. The magic. You're making me tell stories that I haven't told before, at least not publicly. So my senior year in high school, and I mentioned that I was involved in theater. I was actually the head of the theater department there, and there was a gentleman who's still alive. His name is Joe Stevens, and Stevens was kind of like the godfather of magic in the U.S. Owned a magic store here. And he was kind of the godfather in a way, because he was the connecting tissue between just about every magician in the world. He had grown to know them. He would supply them a lot of the magic that they used in their act, or, you know, built that connectivity. And he started putting on conferences in Las Vegas called the Desert Magic Seminars and the likes. And they put on a little show in our high school. And one of the magicians left all of his props behind for a week, saying he'd come back and Okay, you can see where this is going. I had keys to the stage and went in and started kind of sorting through the props and, finding trapdoors and the likes. And by the end of the week, a couple of students along with myself and a couple of cheerleaders were hopping boxes and levitating and the likes on the stage for the custodial staff of an evening. That was just, this once the hook gets into you from magic, it's there. And got to knowing Joe Stevens, and he liked me and I liked him, and he hired me on, and I started developing my magic repertoire, and that was a great way to put me through school. And I stood behind the counter and demonstrated and sold magic little knickknacks to Giant Illusions, and turned into a traveling gig. So we, basically traveled worldwide, selling magic and performing magic and doing magic and producing in early on a great series of magic videos with some of the best magicians in the world.
Wow.
And at a certain point out of school, keep in mind I'm doing school through this,
sure.
I would go out to interview for a potential design job. Mm-hmm. And because everybody knew me for my magic, I would get through the interview and they would look at me and they'd go, "Oh, that's good stuff. Hey, show me a trick." And, so it always kind of devolved from an interview to get a job designing into a free magic show. And I realized at that point I had to kind of put the magic away if I was going to focus on design. And that's kind of what I did. So just kind of tucked it away.
Well, yeah, because there's only really two types of magicians, the struggling to pay the bills magician and the very rich, famous on TV magician. There's no middle class magicians.
Oh, you are so right. And it's not only that, and I hope no magicians are listening to this.
I'm not sure that that's the audience for this, but yeah.
So the second group that you mentioned there, the famous well-to-do, there's five of them. Maybe eight, I don't know, in the world. And everybody else is so struggling. And maybe this tells you something about magicians, but having dealt with and corralled them through conventions and the likes, there's a mindset to a magician that a lot of them have some real ego problems. And there's a lot of divorce amongst them. There's a lot of, a lot of people kind of feel when they see a magician perform that the magician's trying to show that I know something that you don't know.
Sure.
And frankly, for some magicians, that's the reason I think they get into it. Which is really sad because, there's such wonder, and kind of fascination with just being mystified as the magician as you're presenting something. But when you start playing that one-upmanship, there are a lot of magicians that just frankly have some real challenges.
Yeah, I can see that. So you used it to pay through school. Let's back up a little bit. How do you get from
further back with you than I've ever gone with anybody? So
sure,
we're not even talking design yet. No, that's fine.
I know. How do you get from doing business school to going for a degree in design? How does that happen?
Sure. Okay. So, and again, more than anybody wants to know, but wrapped up the business degree and I was going to be going into the family business, which was real estate and real estate appraisal. So I couldn't find myself spending the rest of my life telling people what their houses were worth.
Sure.
That's not a bad, gig, but not what I wanted to do. And it was one of those things where I mentioned I'm the youngest in the family. So there are other siblings that are involved in that business and that I didn't want to, kind of deny them, their sunshine. But I had been involved in a fraternity and was involved in painting the sets. And I used to paint some amazing sets for some productions that we'd do. And I would do some level of design, not even as a designer. And I was always involved in art. So I kind of had that bent. And when I finished up my business degree, I wasn't obligated I was going to state schools. It wasn't terribly costly. And I had my best friend was another magician who was at veterinary medicine school up at Kansas State University.
Because those two go together.
Yeah, there you go. Well,
he can take care of the rabbits, I guess.
No, and he actually did become, I mean, he was the animal tender for vet for Siegfried and Roy and for David Copperfield, for Lance Burton, and because he moved to Vegas. And I mean, that was his part of his gig. He had an extra room and I moved up to Kansas State and bunked with him. And, it was really just kind of, wasn't ready to settle down yet.
Sure.
But figured I needed to take something up there. So started into design up there and really developed that percolating, love for identity, even at that really early age. And one of the things I did was I bought a subscription to print and art direction, both publications that are now dead, Communication Arts, Grafis, Nobruf Grafik, which was a German publication, and no other student had a subscription to these, and that was as close to the internet at the time, because you were seeing almost in real time, just a year behind, what designers were actually designing.
Yeah.
And just really, so started cutting my teeth on the Clarence Lees and the Saul Basses and the Paul Rands and, the Keith Brights. And matter of fact, it was during that period of time that we were doing a magic convention in Vegas. And right before the Vegas convention in Los Angeles, the Magic Castle would always put on their Academy of Magical Arts Awards. And we would go out and participate in part of that. And when we were out in LA, I literally, wrote a letter to Saul Bass and said, "Hey, I'm going to drop by your office. I'd love to visit with you." So gave me the chance to go out and visit with Saul Bass and Richard Follis or John Follis and any number of other designers, going to Hawaii, visiting with Clarence Lee. And it was I was involving this while I was doing the magic, and it really kind of settled in that ability to meet some of these people that were just, icons in the industry at the time and have conversation with them. So
sure. So you wrap up school.
Yep.
The magic, you kind of realize that that's not going to be a necessarily fruitful career. What do you do then?
So I'd mentioned I'd been out interviewing.
Interviews slash magic shows, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'd been so there were any number of companies in Wichita that we knew through family friends and the likes that I started, doing a little bit of freelance work. And I will tell you that the company, I've never actually worked for anybody else. I basically started, at the time it was called Gardner's Graphic Hands, which was an incredibly bad name.
I'm not going to argue with you on that.
Appreciate it, Jason. There was a German company that manufactured magic called Magic Hands, and as a student project, done a logo for myself, like every good design student does. And so I already had that going at the time and soon realized that wasn't a great name. So we changed it. But pretty much just started doing that. Very early on, I recall, since I'd had those subscriptions, getting mailers from different competitions.
Sure.
Saying, drop us some design for X amount of dollars and we'll tell you if you're any good. And, this is when I really didn't have that much money. And to spend money on a competition, and you may know this same feeling, and a lot of designers do, it's one of those real crapshoots. You're kind of going, I'm taking $50, which at the time was a lot of money, that I'm going to spend on this thing that I may never hear back from these people. It's just throwing money out, the window.
Yep.
And I had done a couple of logos in school for some friends and a fraternity buddy of mine that had a lawn service. And I got this mailer from the New York Art Directors Club. And it said, $25 an entry. And I spent $100 and in four entries. and a print magazine. I think for $35, you could submit everything that you had.
Yeah.
The very same day, I got letters back from print and from the New York Art Directors Club. The New York Art Directors Club put three of my pieces in, and this is as a student. And I'm going, no shit. Really? You know, and the prints that I had like four pieces in or something like that. And it's this confirmation that any designer who's ever been accepted into any kind of publication, received that kind of an award. It is just that clarity, that clarion kind of call to, you know, to action, to do more. It's, you know, it's one of those motivating things that happens to people that, just, I've got to share on Logo Lounge. If people want to go to it, they can look over in the articles on the site. There is a young man whose name is Mark Hirons, who's from the UK. And he has a blog, Creative Waffle, I think it is. And his company is called Blue Deer Design. You can find him on YouTube. But if you pull him up, he posted a little video of a box opening that he did when he received his Logo Lounge book, Logo Lounge 10, that he had a logo that had been accepted for. And you just watch this thing, and it was totally, you know, unanticipated when I first saw this, but you can just see this sheer joy on his face. He's going, man, I just got this book, and I can't do his wonderful British accent. He's so great, but he's opening this book up and he's going, yeah, let me see. It was an eagle, and it would be in bird section. He goes to it. There it is. Look, there it is. He's, you know, and he can just, his face just blushes, and I'm going, it's just like I felt the very first time I ever got anything into a publication. You're kind of going, you know, the world's going to beat a path to my doorway. This is my success. This one logo in here. And it's, there's something that happens when that occurs that you can't describe if somebody's not had that experience before, but they will remember it for the rest of their lives. And it's akin to, you know, when they got married or something else like that in their life. To a designer, nothing better.
So you go out and you basically start your own thing right out the gate. Are you taking the advice from your family who were entrepreneurs and how to kind of run things? Because those are, I mean, obviously you went to business school, so you've got that knowledge in there. But running your own business starting off is, in practice, is a lot different than in theory that you learn in school.
Wichita State, where I went to school, actually has a degree in entrepreneurialism and entrepreneurship, and have an entrepreneurship school there. And because of that, I've had a lot of conversations about entrepreneurialism and do some level of teaching out there and the likes. And, you know, really, entrepreneurship is a fancy name for starting your own business. Which people have been doing forever. And, you know, when you were a kid and you went out and you mowed lawns, and, you know, if you had the kind of parents that made you ultimately pay for that lawnmower or the likes, you know, I mean, you're into those early stages of, you know, what it is to run a business. You make X amount of dollars, and if your expenses are less than that, then there's some at the end to, you know, to pay for what you want to do. And starting up a business, I certainly had to step up that my father, we owned a lot of real estate, and his offices had an extra office in it that I put my office in. So I had that advantage. He gave me a foot up there. But, you know, it's not that challenging. And I think a lot of designers do this. You know, it's you go out and you do a couple of jobs and you start to, matter of fact, I hired a my kind of next step in that was hiring a fellow named Steve Wheeler, who I ran into at a grocery store, and I liked a t-shirt he was wearing because it had a cool symbol on it. And he said he'd done it. So I hired him, and he was helping me during that period of time, just starting up. And I can remember I was still going out and interviewing for jobs, and he one day kind of pulled me aside and said, "Bill, you've got a business here. You know, I'm your employee, and I've got a family, and you're, you know." So
yeah,
that's kind of when it sunk in, and I quit interviewing. And from that point forward, it was, you know, hey, this is how it is.
That was your full-time endeavor, and you didn't stop putting your splitting focus, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
So as you're growing things, like you said, you hired somebody early on to help you out.
Yep. Yep.
How do you start determining what things you need filled and what things you can take off your plate and all of that stuff?
Yeah. So anybody who has ever started their own business or hired another designer knows that, the happiness of that individual that you brought on mm-hmm. is really key. You know, I mean, they're going to produce their best stuff if they're happy, and you want to make sure that you've given them good work.
I have a few bosses who did not understand that concept.
Well, you know, and that's why you said you've had a few bosses, you know, past tense, because it's hard to, you have to value their skills. And anybody who knows me or knows of Gardner Design knows that, I'm not saying this in a braggadocious way. I'm saying this, you know, as a what people tell me kind of way. One of my greatest skill sets has probably been recognizing talent and hiring people that are just that have the skill set to become great designers. And I could run a long list of folks that have been my designers and art directors that have gone on to start up their own companies and, to great success in a broad variety of areas in design. And all out of a little Wichita. But it is one of those situations where you want that individual to do well, and you have to give up some of the good stuff that you want to do yourself, you know, realize that you're art directing, and you know that term art direction really means what it says. It doesn't say art direction, I'm the one that designs. It says I'm directing art.
Right.
And a lot of people just don't have clarity on that. You know, you've got to pick up on the idea that you should have as much pride in one of your own designers doing work that, you know, you're kind of going, wow, I wish I had done that.
Yeah.
And to give them the room to be able to do that. So that's probably been one of the kind of keys. Now, I will also say this, that because I have never worked for anyone else, I've always considered myself a really crappy art director. You know, it's good when you have somebody that you're patterned off of. And I did when it came to some level of business through Joe Stevens or my own parents. But from a design standpoint, I learned so much from my designers that they teach me about being a good art director. And that's just kind of how it happens.
Gotcha. So through all this, you're growing things. How are you in the process of all of this, finding new clients? How are you building the business, I guess, is the best way to put that.
Yeah. So this chunk of the conversation is either going to be of absolutely no value to other designers, or it will be of keen value to them. Seriously. Which is and it's one of those questions that I'm perpetually asked by my own, you know, group here is, you know, how do you do this? Where do these clients come from? And the likes. And, there's a lot of ways to develop business. And you can either develop very organically or inorganically. And organic is probably the more natural, which sure. is that, you know, one client mentions you to somebody else's client. And, that, you know, I mean, ultimately, or, you know, somebody you work with at company A leaves there to go to work for company B and hires you again. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's that kind of a thing. But frankly, I've had people comment before. One of my early professors, after I'd been out of school for about 10 years, made a comment in front of me to another group of designers about, you know, Bill, straight out of school, instead of joining an art organization, joined the Chamber of Commerce. Mm-hmm. And he said, other designers wouldn't have joined the Chamber of Commerce.
Sure.
Or other designers wouldn't have joined a business organization or have, you know, and yeah, I mean, I started up the AIGA chapter along with Susan Michalucky and Sonia Gretiman here in Wichita back, you know, in 1990, let's say 89, I think it was. And it was one of the very first AIGA chapters. It was the 16th one in the world, and there weren't very many, and they weren't looking to Wichita to have one.
Sure.
Was a member of the Ad Federation and marketing organizations. But, you know, you start to find by joining these organizations and working with other people that you start developing those contacts mm-hmm. and really getting to know folks in business that are going to hire you as opposed to getting to know your peers as much. You want to know both, but it's the people that hire you that you want to, you know, to get to know. And, you know, it's that level of getting onto various boards and mm-hmm. The likes that give you that working kind of a relationship where you're not prospecting for business as much as you are developing relationships. And think about everything good that's ever happened in your life, Jason. It's sure. It's probably been because you had a relationship with an individual that asked you if you'd do a favor for them, or
yeah
if you
definitely would, for the most part. Mind.
Yep. I mean, it's where a lot of good things come from. And you know, you so and I get that it's, you know, tough for people to have both faces, both a design and a business face in there. But I've shared this in any number of books or columns or the likes that I've written, but think about this. Our field is incredibly subjective.
Sure.
You know, a client comes to you and I and tells us what they want, and you're going to come up with a different solution than I am. Mm-hmm. They can both be equally effective. They can both be tremendous solutions, but there's no chance they're going to be the same.
Right.
If an accountant came to us with a column of numbers and asked us to add them up, you know, we're both going to come up with
there's only one right answer.
Exactly. That's an objective perspective.
Right.
So it's subjectivity versus objectivity. And when you're dealing with people, when you're going into a company and you're dealing with a CFO or a CMO or a CEO, these are people that have gone through business school that have a very objective perspective, especially a CFO. Mm-hmm. And when you go in and you start throwing dollar amounts around about this is what this is going to cost, what's the first question they're going to ask?
Well, what do we get for that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it is, you know, can you prove that if I spend $50,000 here that I'm going to get a return on investment or $50,000 plus in return for it? And we all know the answer to that, which is no.
Yeah.
I can't guarantee you that. But what we can do is, you know, and it's not because we couldn't do some math and say, you know, we think you're going to have X percentage of return on this radio commercial, or you're going to have X percentage of return by putting together this website. But it's that there are so many variables that work into any marketing, you know, program that you just can't equate.
Sure.
But the thing that you can do is you can show that statistically that companies that have a design-centric focus outperform companies that don't. And I'd be glad to share with you so you can share it on here. But there's a there have been any number of studies that have been done. One that was done by the Design Council, which in Britain is kind of the government entity that helps designers, where they took 63 companies in Britain that are design centric, mm-hmm. and they've compared them to the FTSE 100, which is it's the fastest and the best companies in Britain.
Sure.
That stock group. And they found that there was better than a 200% valuation difference in those design companies, that they increased in value over a 10-year period more than 200% from those companies that didn't focus on design. And there was another study that just completed in 2015 for 10 years by a group called Motif Strategies that compared 16 companies that were design-centric. Companies like Macintosh and Coca-Cola and Target, mm-hmm. and Sheraton and Herman Miller, and this group of 16 companies that had a 228% increase in their value of their company over those that were in the Dow Jones average. It just was such an incredible explosion in the amount of value to their company because they valued design, because most of them had a C-level design position, or a vice presidency of design, and they get that value. And you show these numbers to somebody in business, and they look at them and they go, wow, it's kind of hard to argue numbers. So yeah. That's my suggestion here to designers is – put down that next design book that you're going to read, mm-hmm. and pick up a business book, because you're dealing with people that are going to make that decision as to whether or not you work with them partially on your design, but also partially on whether you can make a convincing argument that what you're going to design for them is going to really bring them value.
Yeah.
Wow, that almost sounds like a pitch. I didn't even have to sell at the end of that.
No, I mean, I think that's very true. And it's, I think that can be a challenge for designers to put themselves in that mindset, though. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it. And honestly, not every designer wants to be in business.
Sure.
There's a lot of designers that are just purely happy designing, mm-hmm. and they're tremendous at it. They don't, and they would just assume that somebody else, cut them a check to just let them be happy in design. And that's fine.
I have those days.
Yeah. See, it works.
So as things grow and progress, you start doing more, you start writing articles, you start things like that. How does that all come about?
So this is probably the point where we need to talk about Logo Lounge for just a second.
Sure.
Because that really kind of launches out of that. The experience of starting up the AIGA chapter of my travels and having an opportunity to meet other designers, whether early on through Magic or the likes. As you might be able to tell, I'm a relatively sociable person. I mm-hmm. Can make a friend, get into a conversation pretty easily. And during that period of time, in the young growth of the AIGA in particular, just came to know a lot of very influential designers. We were bringing them in to speak, or I was going out to meet with them, or going to conferences or president's meetings, and knew just enough of them. That's kind of a foundation behind in 2001, we started up Logo Lounge, but it actually started as an idea about in 1998. And it came about because I had eBay had just started up at that time. And eBay, obviously the internet's coming about and people haven't totally figured it out. And I would have designers, if we got into a design project, pull out a David Carter logo book or something like that. Sure. And, they might be designing for, let's say, a theater. And for whatever reason, they wanted to include a rabbit in that logo. So they would be sitting there going, and you've been here through a book post-it noting every page that has a rabbit or, you know, something having to do with a theater on it. And pretty soon you've got this massive stack of books and they've spent days or hours kind of going through them. And I started thinking about, is there a way that digitally all that information could be there? So I could just type in the word theater and all these theater logos came up or rabbit, and all these rabbit logos came up. And eBay, bless their heart, you know, if you think about their model, somebody who's got a teapot to sell in Britain goes on eBay, they put a picture of that teapot up there, they type in a description, and me, here in America, I type in teapot. And all of a sudden, a picture of it pops up with a full description of it, you know, and I'm kind of going, wait, picture, information, searchable, everything is there that basically is what Logo Lounge is. And I thought, God, if they can do it, I can do it. And got together with a gentleman named Troy Tabor. I say gentleman loosely because he was a much younger guy, still a partner, still in here daily. Troy is just a genius on IT and IT architecture and internet very early. And we built the site. The site was designed so that a designer can upload their logo. They pay us a membership fee annual. They upload their logo to the site, put some keywords in there. We started it by going out to all those designers that I had met and offering them foundation memberships, which was a lifetime membership, to upload everything that they had ever done. And the beautiful thing about that is it's a lot of logos that people had never seen before. You know, it was stuff that you could only find in books. And I was asking them to put up their rejects and everything that they could so the world could see their body of work. And when we launched it, we had 2,000 logos. That was all that were on there. And we were asking people for $100 to come on and add their logos and to look at it. And what a silly damned offer. You know, I'm not sure it was a great, you know, I'm not sure how well I thought it through, but designers started embracing it. We hadn't advertised it. Word of mouth just started spreading. And pretty soon we, you know, had tens of thousands of logos that were on this site. And a designer that had just designed a logo for a baker in Australia could upload his logo, and you in Mobile, Alabama, could pull it up and look at that logo he designed before that baker up, you know, sold his first loaf of bread that day.
Sure.
And this idea of immediacy of designers has had a dramatic impact on our industry, because if you think about the timing that occurs, you know, if you went to a bookstore, a bricks and mortar bookstore, and said, man, I'd really love to buy this book because it's going to show me what the design trends are and where things are going right now. If you think back through the logic on that book may have been sitting on the shelf. It may have arrived today, but it, you know, it's probably been sitting there for, you know, 6 months or something like that.
Sure.
That book, the day that they had their call for entry for that book, somebody may have just designed that logo then, but they may have also designed that logo 2 and 3 years before that. Because we publish books. I know how long it takes to publish a book. So, you know, you've got a year to a year and a half in there. So when you pick that book up off the shelf to see what the trends are, you're looking at history. You know, it's a history book.
Sure.
And you're kind of, you know, and the internet has made such a dramatic impact on our industry because it is possible for a trend to ignite and suffocate in a shorter period of time than it is for the public to ever become aware of it.
Sure.
Remember when every designer was drawing a little cross, crossed arrows, crossed wands, crossed hammers, crossed whatever, and it made quadrants. So you'd stick a couple of initials here and here, and you stick a little fire up here and a little heart down here, and you know what, whatever. That never made it to the public.
Right.
It, you know, it started appearing on Logo Lounge and Dribbble and everywhere else that designers were kind of doing this little thing, and every other designer started to do one. So
I'm guilty of it.
It literally lived and died within such a brief period of time. It was snuffed out before it ever really makes it to the public. And people are still doing it mostly, you know, mostly as little portfolio items or something like that. But you now tend to see nuances that occur in what's influencing design in such microbursts that something can either catch on, or it can catch on for a very, very, very brief period of time and then die out.
Sure.
And so I kind of got off track here, but Logo Lounge ends up part of our promise with Logo Lounge is we started developing books, the Logo Lounge series of books, and there have been 10 of them now, not including the Master Library series, which there were four of, and Logo Creed, which is the logo design textbook that we designed.
Oh, I'm not aware of that one.
Yeah. That guy. I'm just realizing this isn't on video, so nobody else can see.
No, but I can see it.
But yeah, you can see. There we go.
I'm not aware of that one. Okay.
There you go.
I'm going to have to go find it.
Yeah, I'll be glad to help you find one. It has turned into a situation where people recognize us for the books. They want to be involved in the books. They want to be in them. They've all been bestsellers in the design industry. And, you know, what I kind of told myself early on, if I can just pay my daughter's way through college with this thing, it's done that. And
I hope so.
it's done okay. So we're in our first year of Logo Lounge, and I get a call from Gordon Kay, who's the publisher and a longtime friend now of Graphic Design USA. Mm-hmm. And he says, Bill, would you be interested in writing an article about logos for us with Logo Lounge and the likes? And at the time, Kathy Fischel was a partner of mine, and Kathy is a great writer for the industry, our industry. And we got to talking, and we decided to do a logo trend report, first of its kind. And it was basically we picked out 15 different directions that we were seeing that we could identify as directions logos were going in. And he calls up the next year and said, Bill, that was one of the best read articles. We've had such great response. Would you be willing to do it again? Mm. So here we find ourselves, 16 years later, I'm sitting here working this weekend on, you know, logo trend report number 16. And it evolved and turned into more and more of something I was already speaking, you know, and having the opportunity to, you know, to go to conferences in Russia and Kiev and London and around the world, you know, with this now, and talking about, you know, identity design and what makes it work, what doesn't make it work, why certain things are happening. And these logo trend reports now have evolved into, as I maybe indicated at the beginning of this conversation, to not only being reproduced in I don't know how many different languages, kind of hoping that they're being faithful to whatever I've written.
I guess that's the best you can do.
it is. And, you know, and they're still being printed in four or five different, you know, paper type of publications outside of, you know, all over the internet. The How Design Conference, How Design Live, was so kind as to invite us to premiere the trend report 4 years ago in Boston. And here we are 4 years later, still doing it every year for them. Uh-huh. And one of the larger audiences that they pile together at How Design Live. And that always feels good to get the big room to be able to present these in and kind of go, really, there's that many people that want to hear this. And we probably started about 5 years ago with lynda.com, which is now LinkedIn Learning. Uh-huh. And if your listeners aren't familiar with that, one of the most absolutely best of class gold premier ways that you can learn from some of the very best designers. Von Glitchke has been a member of it for some time, producing courses on there. I think I've got 7 or 8 courses on there now and getting ready to go out and do a couple more this year. We present the trends through that with some extra content. And that's cool to watch because you really get some in-depth behind the trend reports. But they've truly become this living entity of their own. And you you see these little nuances occurring. And the thing I love about the Trend Report, and I'm hoping that people really listen to this next line that I say, sure, which is that every year when we post the Trend Report, we get a email back from somebody or a group of people saying, well, thank God I didn't make the Trend Report. I would hate to be thought of as being trendy. And I want people to realize this. It isn't a trendy report. It's there is a look it up. There's a difference between the word trend
and trendy.
And the word trendy.
Yes.
Trend just indicates the direction something is going.
Sure.
And you know, it's kind of like don't shoot the piano player, you know, because I'm delivering the news of what I am seeing out there. Mm-hmm. And some of the directions I see identity going, I don't agree with. Some of them I do. Some of what I publish, I think is crap, but it's where it's going. And, like on the last Trend Report, we literally went through one at a time, 37,000 logos, you know, Jeez, in the please. Original sort. That leads to, you know, the content on this. And it's one of those deals where we try to be as objective with our subjectivity, trying to narrow these down. We work with other designers to narrow our field once we may have 40 or 50 different directions to what they think are the most relevant out of these. But you look at these things and you can start to see like monoline. You start to see how monoline first kind of started to develop and how it starts to branch off into other trends.
Sure.
And how lines start to get thicker or lined areas start to infill with color or monoline starts moving towards hip kind of hipsterish, crests or badges. Mm-hmm. And you start to see all of this, or you see transparency as it first emerges and you can barely find a transparent logo. And then to the point where you see massive amounts of transparency or color going from flat to gradations and all the shifts and variables that it runs through on this kind of pendulum swing of activity, you know, moving towards very Spartan type now that we're in from a period of time when you were dealing with type that had every zip trigger and everything going on inside of it.
Sure.
So it is a matter of kind of seeing this evolution that occurs from point A to point B. And I tell a lot of people that it's more important to know how you got there than to know where you are. It's real easy for a designer to look at what other designers are doing and go, oh, I want to do something kind of like that.
Yeah.
But they don't know why that designer did that. They don't know what happened before that that led that to be a good solution. Mm-hmm. And the other thing they don't know is they don't know how to evolve that design forward.
Mm-hmm.
Evolution didn't just happen. Something happened beforehand that led to evolutionary process, you know, so you can, you can see some design element going through its machinations up to the point that it is now. And as a designer, I think that you recognize that it's something where it may not be up here at the frontal part of your mind. It may be in the back, but you know that, well, people were kind of doing that 3 or 4 years ago. But if I took this idea and I twisted it this direction, uh-huh, if I stood on this designer's shoulders and pushed it to the next, you know, plateau, this might be where it would go. What happens if I take monoline and transparency and blend them together? What mm-hmm. happens if I marry those two together? And you can start to imagine what would happen in there. You know, what happens if I start to do that with typography instead of with a flat image? You know, mm-hmm. where would that, how would it look? What happens if all of a sudden there's a bit of a shadow on this, you know, because I'm seeing shadows kind of coming in? Is that good? Is it bad? Do I want to abandon that? Do I want to move forward? So it informs designers as they're starting to think forward about their design. And, you know, so at this point, I probably have lost half of your listeners.
I'm following you.
It's one of those things where you can tell that I get pretty impassioned about, you know, the reality of what causes design to happen the way that it does.
Right.
Not just, I love designing,
Yeah.
But I also love to know how it got there. And that's what you get from the trend reports.
Sure. You know, as you're going through all of these things, how often do you stumble upon something that's you just look at it and you're like, where the hell did that come from?
WTF?
And not in a bad way, because there are
there are
plenty that you can look in and go, where the hell did that come from?
Well, you just nailed what's the greatest lark about this whole thing was when that happens. So if you read the trend reports, or if you've been there before, and by the way, you can go to Logo Lounge and look at every trend report from, you know, the very first one 16 years ago. You'll note that I generally write two long paragraphs for each trend, where I talk about, you know, how it's being used, where I think its influence is. There's a lot of snarkiness in there because I'm just a smart, snarky individual. But it generally is information that's in there to help you understand the context of where it came from. Mm-hmm. And I do my best to try and discover that. Sometimes on those descriptions, you look at them and I'll say, honest to God, I have no idea. I have no idea where this came from. And there's a if you look back a couple of years, and I always name all these trends, and I'm trying to recall what the heck I named this one. There was one that looks a little bit like it almost looks like a snowboard, if you will, that has a really exaggerated, you know, center section where it bows in. Right. Okay, I got to be honest. What it really looks like is a feminine hygiene pad, except I couldn't name it that. But, you know, it's got it? Okay. Yep. Okay, except it's kind of warped and curled. Mm-hmm. So it kind of curls in. And all of a sudden, 2 years ago, people started using these shapes, these dimensional shapes, and you put a couple of them together and you almost kind of go, well, it kind of warps around a sphere. It kind of forms a globe, or they nestle with each other. But all of a sudden, there was a shape that just came out of nowhere that everybody was adopting. And you get to times like that and you're lost for any explanation. You know, you do your best, but yeah, you're absolutely right. There are those things that develop that you just look at, or that just come totally out of the blue, and it may be a resurrection of things. You know, I'll tell you that, you know, even though we've been through this period of time where we're dealing with incredibly Spartan fonts that are generally sans serif, that a couple of things have happened that have been influencers. Stranger Things, the show, the kind of retro back to the 80s, 90s kind of fonts that were used in that particular graphic for the show, for its logo, certainly have kind of a skew back to an homage to that period of time that people are starting to pick up on. And you're starting to see serif fonts coming back in word marks that kind of have this more voluptuous roundedness, or, you know, those unique serifs that were indicative of that particular time. Sure. That are kind of starting to lift up. And I think that's one of the fun things about this is that, you know, to a certain degree, you can see where identities or design lifts out of itself.
Sure.
But the other thing that is the greater truth is that our identity, what happens in design lifts out of our culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it might be a car commercial. It might be a fashion trend. It might be, you know, an individual, a celebrity, you know, that influences something. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be a prince deciding that he's going to change his name to whatever that symbol is. You know, it might be, you know, seriously. And it's all of these things. You know, a lot of times I see that design draws out of user interface. That's kind of an early development phase. And you think about user interface designers and why are they designing the way they are? And it's usually because they can compact information into an area much more effectively if they are very into reductionism. Mm-hmm. And you know, so thus, you know, what is a logo? It's reduction of a lot of information down to a nugget. And so you start to see some of that that carries across. Long shadows, when they were popular, came out of user interface. There's a wonderful story behind where transparency started to enter into identity design and how that came about that is related to I'll tell this story real quick.
Sure.
For those designers that are old enough to remember the name Enron, Enron was an investment company that had some of the smartest guys in the world working at it down in Texas. Uh-huh. And they were trading futures on things that were very ethereal, that didn't exist. And they got caught up on their own petard and ended up going bankrupt and causing the failure of, you know, certain markets. Put a lot of people in the financial industry into a bad position. It was also a logo
that's almost been designed. Almost completely derailed the internet too, because they were the largest holding company for fiber optics and cable companies.
Yeah. And, you know, exactly. And it was a logo, unfortunately, had been designed by Paul Rand. That was a pretty cool logo.
Yeah.
But here's what happened. If you move yourself back in time as a designer to that very same window in time, if we wanted to design something that showed some level of transparency, one object through another, we would do it in Photoshop.
Sure.
And depending on how well people remember, if you wanted to see what something looked like in that way in Photoshop, what you would do is you would move one object over on top of the other, and then you would take a lunch break because your computer would be spending time calculating what the heck that was going to look like, because, you know, you'd come back from lunch and it was just about done, you know. Yep. It would be, you know, things didn't happen in real time in design.
Yep.
And you know, eventually it looks like this, and you're like, I don't like that. What would it look like if I, oh, the hell with it, you know?
I'll do that at the end of the day.
I'll skip that idea. Yeah. Exactly. You know, I could fake it out. And Illustrator came out with the ability at that very same time that Enron is going down,
mm-hmm,
to achieve a transparency, mm-hmm, using Illustrator tools, and it could happen in real time.
Yeah.
So that you could sit there and you could experiment. You could, that kind of looks like this, or it kind of looks like that. Okay, back to Enron. What happens? Every financial institution that is going through a period of time, whether it's a rebranding or not, and they're saying, we need to build credibility with our consumers so that they know that we are being good stewards of their funds.
Mm-hmm.
What's the word that the financial industry comes up with to define that? Transparency.
Yeah.
They go, we need to show our customers this transparency of the use of their funds so that they can see how they're being used, what we're doing with them. You know, they can feel comfortable with this use of funds. These people are coming to marketers,
mm-hmm,
designers, and they're going, we need to convey this aspect of transparency to consumers. What's the designer thinking?
Holy
shit! I just got this new tool in Illustrator that can make transparencies.
Yeah.
So, and really, it's taking this literal aspect of the word transparency, and it's applying it to this figurative, you know, sure, simile of, you know, what we're trying to convey. And we're able to go to, you know, Merrill Lynch, who, uh-huh, did Merrill Lynch's cafeteria plan, where you could select from these various plans. And they took their bull logo and they put it right with this series of transparent overlapping, you know, colored squares back behind it. And it was, mm-hmm, one of the very first transparent logos, you know, that kind of came out from that. But many more came out of it. And it's, they're able to go to their boards and their consumers and go, you know what, this is us demonstrating our level of transparency. And that literally was the impetus. It was, you know, the seminal point at which transparency came into its own within identity design and within the design industry.
Huh.
Was you know, leading out of a financial crisis and the serendipity of Illustrator introducing a tool at the time that, you know, was in great need to achieve transparency.
Wow.
Huh. There you go. What do you need to know?
Yeah, that's very interesting. So, you know, we're kind of getting close to our time, but I want to ask two questions here. And one was from Vaughn. He actually sent me a message on Twitter when I told him I was talking to you, was to ask you about the challenges you ran into with some of your work in India, showing up in India.
Ah, oh, okay. Well, Vaughn and I have some kind of similar opportunities that occur out there. And that is, as most designers do, which is Vaughn tells a story of, some of his tribal designs that he's designed. He's had it. This happened with many other things, you know, showing up as for sale tattoos. Uh-huh. And it's not for sale through him. It's, you know, appropriated design. And so we both have had a lot of our design that other people have decided that was theirs. And one of our Logo Lounge members, frankly, and this probably happens in some way, maybe five or six times a year with some of our design work.
Sure.
One of our Logo Lounge members sent me this thing, and there was a mall in a major city in India, and I'm talking a massive shopping mall. Mm-hmm. That I had designed a logo for a bank in Oklahoma. And it was a logo design that we hadn't used. And we load up our logos, whether we used them or not, Logo Lounge, as most designers do. And it was a very distinctive mark. It was kind of a star pattern that kind of grew out of leaves, but it was something that, you know, I mean, you don't just get to accidentally. It's one of those, you know, oh, that's so-and-so's design.
Yeah.
And they send me this thing for this mall, and there's this massive sign on the outside of the mall that had to have cost, you know, $100,000 sign, you know, that's my logo. And there in the center court of, as I go to the website and I'm looking through, of this mall inlaid in marbles and granites in the center court, which is probably 50 foot across, is this giant version of this logo that, you know, in multicolored stone that's been laid in there. So basically had my attorney call their attorney. I've got a good – everybody out there needs to have a good IP attorney, just as a friend. And he contacted him and said, love the design work that you guys have. Maybe it'd be nice if you actually owned it. And we ended up doing very well because they had the option of either – excavating that center court and the way that the logo had been used throughout, or they changed the color, but that was it. And it was so evident. And it's one of those, you know, sometimes some of our most lucrative design work is the work that didn't get used by our client, but somebody else appropriates it. So there's the story of the logo being used in India. I'm sure I could put some funnier stuff in there, like the attorney took a good chunk of the fee, but, you know, anyway.
And that's sad. That's
That's okay.
That's what attorneys do, though. So
No. But, you know, we wouldn't have ever had it. So, you know, there. That's what happens.
Yeah. And then, you know, we kind of touched on this at the top of the show, but what all exciting do you have coming up? I know you're working on the latest trend report, and you've got a couple speaking gigs coming up, but what else is on your plate that you can talk about?
You know, you and I had a real quick conversation, yesterday, about Creative South, and I've got to tell you, I'm exuberant about, the people that, I've heard about so far that are going to be, speaking along with me, and even more exuberant about the people that have contacted me that, are going to be down there. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, sounds like an amazing, conference, and, I've not been to it before, but everybody just says glowing things about it. So, that's kind of at the top of my list right now. I've got, as I indicated, the trend report, is absorbing all the oxygen around me right now, with the exception of this interview. And it's a blast to be as deep into it as I am. But I've got another Linda course. Actually, the Logo Creed book that I mentioned to you, we're dividing up into three sections in a series of courses on LinkedIn Learning. Mm-hmm. And it is, we've just completed the first one, which will be up, I think if it's not up now, it'll be up soon, called Discovery, which is this entire portion of what happens before you ever put your pencil to paper. Mm-hmm. You know, it's before you start drawing, it's meeting with the clients and gathering of information and trying to determine their personality and trying to determine what is unique about that client that you're going to define them as in the identity and the brand that you build for them. And so this next one I've got coming up that we're going to be doing here this fall is going to end up, and that's going to be on the actual design of the identity. Mm-hmm. And we're going to, we're in the midst of redoing a brewery right now called Aeroplanes Brewing that I'm just loving what our designers have come up with on this. And it's very smart. And for a while there, they made some kind of bad beer, and now they've got a head brewmaster that has come in from another brewery that just is making some exquisite tasting microbrews, and we're loving that work that we're doing right now, and that we're going to focus in on that particular project, mm-hmm. Which I think that the people that watch those courses are going to really enjoy. What else goes on? I'm going to go watch my team, Wichita State, play down in Orlando here the day after Vaughn and I speak in Tulsa. I'm hopping onto a plane to go down to Orlando and watch 3 days of basketball down there. Hopefully Wichita State will pull through and we'll go on to the tournament because I love watching them play ball.
Sure.
I've got a daughter who's just inches away from graduating from the architecture program with a master's at Kansas State University. And she's already taken a job and she's coming back here to Wichita because she loves Wichita and has a job here as an architect. And, so, gosh, I'm the luckiest person in the entire world, Jason.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like you've got a lot on your plate and all. But real quickly, where can people find you online? Yeah.
Online. I think we sent across a couple of, if you look at hashtags, hashtag, we're at Gardnerisms, mm-hmm. GARDNERISMS. That will get you there. They can obviously link to all of our social media through GardnerDesign.com or through LogoLounge.com. I am all over LinkedIn, and this last couple of days, Vaughn is a master poster of social media.
Yes,
and he is. And because of that link of the two of us together, I think I've made about somewhere in the zone of 30 new friends wanting to link up with me on LinkedIn. Agatha Sherwin, who I've never heard of, but she came to me through Vaughn and is on my desktop right now. I'm just, so it's great to make connectivity with people. And honest to God, I am probably one of the easiest people to reach in the world. And I love to talk and I love to share and I love to hear what other people are doing. So awesome. Anybody that ever wants to pick up the phone and call me or text me or email me, feel free to, because I'm out there and pretty easy to reach.
Awesome. Bill
at GardnerDesign.com. There we go.
All right, Bill, thank you so much for taking the time to talk,
Jason,
with me today.
Absolutely.
It's been a pleasure. And
you and I are going to have to spend some more time together down at the conference so I can catch up with you some more.
Definitely. We definitely will.
Very good.
We will see you in a few weeks.
Okay. Looking forward to it.
All right. Go out and hug some necks.
Okay. We'll do it. Thanks, Jason.
You can find out more about Bill on Twitter at Gardnerisms. And be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at Creative SO Pod. And follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Creative South GA, over at CreativeSouth.com. and I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Jack Prince is giving Creative South Podcast listeners 15% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code SOUTH15OFF at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today. For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CreativeSouth. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.